A smart person learns from their mistakes. A wise person learns from others' mistakes. Welcome to the My Mistakes Podcast. We cover the lessons learned from the mistakes we've made in business so you won't do the same. I'm Chris Cianciulli. Today's guest is Ivan Monclova. Find out what this dedicated Marine colonel with more than 20 years of experience can teach us about team building and how we can take those lessons and apply them to our businesses. This episode is being brought to you by Don Pablo Coffee. Specialty grade beans roasted in small batches. It's a better cup of coffee. Get yours at Amazon or at DonPabloCoffee.com. So on the My Mistakes podcast for this episode today, I brought someone on who I met this week, and I was very impressed by his story. And when I heard the years of service that he had in the military, one, it made me think how tough I am not. And two, it made me wonder what is entailed or what goes into filling that role. Very often in business, we talk about team building and it's for the growth of the business. It's to expand the business. It's to generate money to pay for employees so the business can continue operating. But taking that same philosophy and applying that to our military and our defense of what keeps us safe as Americans, that was something that intrigued me. So today on the program, we have Ivan Monclova, who, Ivan, if you can give a little introduction of yourself, branch of military, what got you into it, little intro.
Yeah. Hey, first of all, good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on. My name is Ivan Monclova. I'm currently a colonel in the United States Marine Corps. As you mentioned, I got 26 years of service. I just finished my last duties as the commanding officer for Marine recruiting in the Northeast. So from the Potomac to Maine over to Ohio, about 1,000 Marines and civilians working on bringing in new officers and enlisted into the Marine Corps.
Okay. If you can start off with telling me, what is the ranking system? Because like you said, colonel, and I know that that's high up, but I don't know how high up. So if you can explain that.
Sure. So there's 10 officer ranks in the military. Each of the services names them a little bit different. In the Marine Corps, you start off as a second lieutenant, first lieutenant, captain, major, lieutenant colonel, then colonel. Beyond that, you've got your four general ranks, which is a brigadier, general, major general, lieutenant general, and then finally the four-star generals like Mattis or Dumford, you're probably familiar with. They're just called generals.
With those officer positions, how does someone get the opportunity to go out for a position as an officer?
So, you know, the fundamental requirement is a college degree, but there's mental, moral, and physical requirements for any entry into the military. They're fairly similar across the services. You know, the fundamental piece to get your foot in the door is getting medically tested, having your college degree, passing some tests, and then you get a shot at basically trying out. And there's a number of entry paths, whether it's ROTC in college, the academies, or OCS, which was my route, which I went into as I was a junior in college at Purdue. I spent 10 weeks getting screened and evaluated by our officer candidate school in Quantico to see if I had what it took to be a Marine officer.
And what got you into the military? Is it something you always wanted to do? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, so that's actually a pretty interesting story. I was born in Panama to a dad who was in the Army for 30 years, and he was stationed there. And to be honest, when I went to Purdue, I had no intention of joining the military. But the first Gulf War kicked off, and I realized, wow, there's going to be a war. I'm going to miss it. I got to go do my part. I actually went down to the Army recruiter to enlist. He laughed at me and said, hey, you're not going to make it there in time. You're in college. If you're interested in serving, go see the Army ROTC program and join up that way. And I did that and started to participate in the Army program. But then I saw these guys who were working out in the same area. I'm like, hey, who are those guys? They're like, oh, don't talk to them. They're Marines. I was like, huh, that of course was the worst thing to ever tell a young guy, right? Don't go do something. So I went and talked to them and really, I was entranced with what the Marine Corps offered, and it seemed like one more notch up on the challenge belt. So that's the direction I went.
Was your dad, being an Army guy, was he bothered, upset, hurt because of the decision?
No, not at all. You know, he was an infantry guy. He was a battalion commander in Vietnam. He knew exactly what I was getting into, and he was actually very excited about the opportunity. And, you know, my grandfather had also served in the U.S. Army in World War I, but my dad was very supportive about it. He was a little nervous. He said, man, those guys are kind of crazy, but, you know, go for it. So, no, he was very supportive of me, and he did a lot of coaching and mentoring for me. I mean, to this day, he's still alive. He's 87. I mean, he's always been a great muse for me.
He was in World War II, correct?
No. So my grandfather was in World War I. He joined at 17 years old, enlisted. They turned him into an officer, a second lieutenant at the age of 17, and fought in World War I. It was my dad actually served in Vietnam as a battalion commander back in 68.
So did you feel, is that why you went running down to a recruitment center once the Persian Gulf? It looked like we were going to war because you felt an obligation with your grandfather and father both serving in a war?
You know, I don't know what it was, but I was sitting there watching the TV, and I wasn't too excited with the way my path was going. I was in engineering, and I was facing this life. I was like, boy, I can't imagine sitting in a cubicle every day, never seeing the sun. What am I going to do with myself? And I just saw what was going on. I was like, wow, you know what? If I'm going to live my life, I want to live it to the fullest. And something just clicked in me. I mean, obviously, I was well-versed in the military life, but I really had discounted it until I saw it on the TV. And I was like, man, I gotta make a life change right now and be part of this.
When you get there and you had already gone to college, so you had experience living away from home, but here you're young guy, finished college to your, it's called basic training, correct?
Yeah, for officers. Yeah, there's a process, and there's a number of schools that take you from, you know, not knowing anything to progressing you both just as a basic officer, and then you go into your specialty course. For me, it was the infantry officer course, which is also in Quantico. You spend an additional 10 weeks really getting honed and being able to be prepared to lead a platoon of Marines when you get out to the Fleet Marine Force.
So you're going in for officer training. Are you not at that level that you see, I guess, like privates, or because of the education, your trajectory is a little bit different than someone who just goes down to a recruitment center at 17, correct?
Yes, it's a different process. When you go to boot camp, that is a training pipeline that we establish. When you go to officer candidate school, I mean, there's a variety of methods, but let's just say you go for a 10-week officer candidate school. There is some training involved, but really the purpose of officer candidate school is to screen and evaluate you physically, mentally, morally, put you under incredible pressure and see if you have the basic stuff to be an officer. The real training really begins after that, if you survive OCS. And it's a pretty high dropout rate and washout rate at officer candidate school. That is followed up by what we call the basic school, which is 6 months of intensive training, also in Quantico. That's really where we do the majority of the basic officer training in the Marine Corps side. And then you go to on a follow-on specialty school, depending upon what your specialty is going to be, whether you're going to be a pilot, or you're going to be a communicator, infantry guy like myself. Then you go to further training. And those training packages are different depending upon that specialty.
What skill set are they looking for, and what are they turning away?
So, you know, fundamentally, what we like to see is it's always difficult to determine how someone is going to react when they're exhausted, when they're put underneath incredible pressure, and we give them responsibility. So one of the big aspects that we do at Officer Candidate School is to place you into billets of responsibility. So you'll be temporarily in charge of another group of candidates who are going through the same thing you are. And you're responsible for getting everything done. And the drill instructors there, we call them sergeant instructors, and the staff there are going to put you into impossible situations. They're going to force you often to fail at what you're doing. And we simply want to see how you react. And we have a very tried and true method of evaluating, hey, is someone going to crumble? Are they going to rise to the occasion? Will they take responsibility for the mistakes they make? Will other people follow them? I mean, your peers are an amazing evaluator of your potential. And there's some people that their peers won't. I mean, they won't do what what you ask them to do. And that's an indicator that you lack some of that basic stuff, and some of it's intangible, that we're looking for to lead other people in the most difficult of situations.
When you had your first position as an officer, when you had people that weren't much younger than you, almost your age, showing you that respect and responding the way that it's outlined or it's supposed to be in the military, what is that like for you and for your ego as a young person experiencing that?
Each officer probably takes that a little bit differently because, you know, one of the dynamics is, you're right, some of the Marines that are in your first unit, they're, you know, 4 or 5 years younger than you, but you also have a platoon sergeant who is often older than you, has been in the Marine Corps for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, sometimes longer. One of my sergeants had been in for 12 years. His nose was sideways across his face because he had knocked out an officer and been NJP'd. So, you know, you get a wide range of individuals that you have to lead. It's very intimidating. And Marines will certainly obey the rank, but they'll let you know pretty quickly if they respect you as a no-kidding, genuine leader. And those first formative years as an officer are really critical, and the lessons that you take away. And, you know, for most officers, I think, out there, it's a very humbling experience because you have some amazing individuals that you're put in charge of, but it's pure excitement. It's a lot of fun.
What did you learn about yourself in that first stage of becoming an officer?
I realized how little I knew. I realized how much bigger the world was, the complexity. You know, it's very easy to get sucked into the tactical, but you start to realize that you're part of a massive, massive organization, and that it goes all the way up to the political realm. You know, how our civilian masters at Office of Secretary of Defense, and certainly whoever's the president at the time, Congress, you start to get a real sense of the incredible weight of the institution that you're part of, and the responsibility to represent it well, and somehow make your little corner of that huge organization yours, and make it a place that you're, the Marines who work for you can find the value in it and are excited to be part of it and not get lost in kind of that big machine.
Now, in business, it's the CEO who is the head of the company, who has the vision of the direction that it's going to go in and sets that culture. Now, without getting political or mentioning any views on either a political party or the office of the presidency, I want to just look at the office, which is something that I respect tremendously. And I do consider myself, I wouldn't say a scholar, but I'm very into U.S. presidential history. And I've read many, many, many of the autobiographies and biographies of many of the U.S. presidents. And if that's the CEO of the country or company, as an officer in the Marines, what is that like if one of the presidents that we've had in the time that you've been in the military, if you don't personally agree with certain policies or certain actions that are being given as orders, what is that like? Or even if not with you, what is the culture or what is expected of you when given certain tasks that are something that you personally wouldn't have chosen or done?
You know, so I think the military has really cracked the code on this. And we, you know, obviously we fill a unique position in the government of the United States where it is really inculcated into us that we really disregard as far as who is in charge. We're going to serve either party, whoever's in charge, we're going to serve them equally well. You know, we will give always our best military advice to those civilians that determine the direction we want to go. We will give them our honest, absolute, you know, most accurate feedback that we can based off the knowledge that we have. But once they make a decision, we salute and we execute. And that's really fundamentally what we do. And, you know, at the core of being a Marine, it's to obey. And you really don't want a military that is going to have each individual going off in their own direction based off political decisions, right? I mean, we got to execute faithfully per lawful orders. And, you know, I've really never had a conundrum with that. And it's really the responsibility of our general officers to have those kind of frank discussions with the political leadership. And that sits way higher up than most members of the military will serve at or experience. For us, the culture is really based upon our senior military leadership within our service.
If you were giving advice to an officer who isn't ranked as high as you are, or taking this and applying it to the business world, what is something or a piece of advice that you would give to anyone stepping into a leadership role?
Well, I think the first and most important part, and it, when you go into a company, is to ask the right questions and from your boss, right? And if there's any doubt as to the direction that they want to go, the vision, the culture, and some define it very well. I mean, if you take a look at an Amazon, they lay out their 14 leadership principles and you know exactly what's expected. So that makes it easy for you to then translate down to those that are working for you or you're in charge of. So that's always the first thing that I tell is, you know, part of the responsibility as a leader in any organization is to make sure that you can accurately interpret the direction the company wants to go and be able to articulate it and turn it into action with those that you've been placed in responsibility. And even better, if you can learn each individual, learn what their needs and motivators are, and then show them how those align with the benefits and the direction the company is going, then you can change your leadership style from just something that's transactional or autocratic into something that's inspirational and move in a common direction.
Interesting. Which leaders in U.S. history, military-wise, would you want to share their story about to either anyone reporting to you or to myself or to listeners? Like, whose story inspired you and why?
Boy, there's a couple out there. You know, there's a major who was in the Marine Corps. His name was Ellis, and he had a lot of personal faults. He was a bit of a personal mess, but he was a guy who went out into on his own under very vague guidance out to the Pacific and really provided some of the key intel and planning emphasis that prepared us for our success in World War II. And what I find fascinating about him is that this was not a perfect individual. He was an ordinary man who did some extraordinary things and had some great, incredible value to the organization, despite all his faults. And I find that always useful in remembering that we're not all have to be some kind of Superman. We all tend to be ordinary people who get a chance to do extraordinary things and shouldn't be afraid to do that. And on the flip side, I love, you know, I mean, looking at a story of, you know, General Mattis is somebody who I really enjoy following and seeing, you know, how he managed to really become an incredibly successful wartime leader within the Marine Corps in a joint service that, you know, we've had fairly good results as a Marine Corps, but I think he's really one of the outstanding examples that we've had.
Would you say that he's someone who has a lot of respect from those who serve under him as a whole?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, he's absolutely loved by those who have served with him, and just his approach, the way he could communicate so clearly, not just to officers, but the most junior Marine, 17, 18-year-old, you just got the sense from General Mattis that he was going to take care of you, he was in your corner, and that he had a sense of purpose and his decisions. You just knew 98% of them were going to be right and on target. And that led to a huge level of trust.
Trust of a leader and someone that is your decision maker, may it be in a company, state government, federal government, any leader. How important do you put trust, and how do you feel that trust is earned?
It is fundamental. And that loyalty, that trust has to go down as much as it does go up. You know, a lot of people who are in positions of authority expect loyalty, expect the trust of their subordinates. But if you don't put yourself out there for them when the cards are down, because people are going to make mistakes. So one of the key things that I would often do, you know, particularly recently, I had some great majors who are in command recruiting stations for me across the Northeast. Sometimes I would see them going down a path where I knew they were going to make an error or a mistake. But I would coach him in Metro, but I'd let them make that mistake. One, because I knew it was going to be a terminal mistake, but sometimes you got to make it. And then when they made it, I didn't fry them. I didn't lose my mind. I let them learn from it. I'd cover their six, you know, I'd umbrella them from any kind of heat from higher. And that built a level of trust. They knew that they could grow, maneuver, experiment with their leadership under my care. And that made all the difference in the world.
That's interesting. My daughter, who's in second grade, we had a virtual open house with her teacher last week. And the teacher suggested to us parents, it's very important at some point in the next month, when you're doing something, screw up. Mess up in front of your child. Let them see you mess up. Let them see you not overreact. Let them observe how you handle it and how you remedy the problem so that they will see that when they make a mistake or have a screw up, it's not the end of the world and they won't get so hard on themselves. So it's interesting hearing the same kind of thing that is being advised for a second grader is also the same good, pertinent advice that is used at this higher level. How many people with your position were you in charge of or reporting to you?
So the way that my district was structured, I had 8 major subordinate units called recruiting stations. So each of those was led by a major. They had a SART major, a recruiter instructor, and they each of them were different size depending upon the area. So like RS New York, which is the largest recruiting station in the East Coast, they're larger than, say, a Pittsburgh, which is a smaller station. So each one is 100, 150 strong, depending upon, you know, population density.
I'm assuming that when you walk in a room, does everyone that's in that recruiting station stand up and salute you?
So we don't salute indoors, but yes, they do stand up. They go to the position of attention. Usually when a senior officer walks into a room, the senior individual in that room before you walk in will call attention on deck, and then you put them at ease, and then you begin a conversation.
Does that ever get old, or is that something that kind of like strokes the ego somewhat to be given that respect?
So it absolutely gets old, because I usually want to get in there and turn right to business. Even to this day, I'm somewhat embarrassed by it. Everybody probably takes it a little bit differently, but we do things for a reason. It reinforces the positional piece of our authority. It's a reminder that we are part of a system that has rules and consequences and that we obey. And I stand up at the position of attention when my boss walks in and the general comes in. And so there's a reason for it, and it's a good reason. But yeah, sometimes it's like, hey, I just want to get in here and get to work. But those traditions that we have are tried and true, and it reinforces the glue that keeps us together.
You said that you don't salute indoors, but you'll stand at attention. Now, I know that right now we're going to get to that in a couple of minutes as far as transitioning and entering the workforce, no longer being active in the Marine Corps. However, if you were in the same room and General Mattis were to walk into a room, would it almost be second nature, or would you automatically stand at attention out of respect?
Yeah, I don't think I could help myself. I mean, that's just, you know, once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine. And, you know, if someone that I know is of a higher rank than me, I'll absolutely stand up. But it's a greeting amongst warriors, too. It's a common respect for the shared challenge that we know we've all faced. Without hesitation, I would do that.
So in business, I was listening to a podcast of someone who's CEO of a large company, and he was saying how sometimes, not following the chain of command, but he might see someone who's a little off their game, or he might approach them and talk to them and see what's up and why they're not performing at the level they should be. How does it work in the military or in the Marines in particular? Are you speaking to anyone or getting answers, or do you always follow that chain of command where you are indirectly going to communicate with someone, or can someone come directly to you?
Yeah, so there's, you know, like every place else, there's cultural norms, you know, when you follow the chain of command, when you shouldn't. I've always had an open door policy. I think most commanders in the Marine Corps do. We also have guaranteed protected communication. So even the most junior member of a unit can always request MAST, can always walk into the office of the most senior commander that he has in the chain and request permission to speak with them. And I've always found that the best way to even make it easier for them is to be highly approachable and spend the majority of your time walking around, talking to everybody and building that relationship, not, you know, being holed up in some office and making it intimidating for them to come see you. But don't even wait for that. Just walk around constantly. And, you know, for the past 3 years, while I was on recruiting duty, I traveled around 3 weeks out of every four, constantly talking to those working for me, having those conversations with them immediately.
The total number was something around 1,000 people were under your command, correct?
That's about right. You know, it would flux depending on the time of the year. We would get people who would check in for short periods of time. So that's about the average.
Looking at different organizations like teachers or in some big companies that I can think of, you'll hear, call them subordinates, you'll hear things said or they don't like certain decisions that are coming from the top, and there'll be attitudes or things said under their breath. What would you advise to someone who is, let's say, in the workplace, who has an issue with something that they need to be doing or they were instructed to do, but they don't agree with it? Were there ever any times where you ran into that situation or had to set someone straight because they weren't agreeing with something that they needed to carry out?
Yeah, sure. So part of the process that we have is, you know, as we're starting to go through a decision-making cycle, there are certainly appropriate times to bring up concerns. We relish challenge to decisions that we're starting to make. As we're trying to figure out the direction to go on an issue, we openly seek all the points of views, divergent, minority report, you know, the person who completely disagrees with the current trend that everyone's talking about. But once we finally make the decision that usually, you know, falls on the commander, then the expectation is that we then execute it as if it was, you know, your idea. That's the expectation. If at that point someone is continuing to gripe or doesn't want to get on board, then that becomes a more serious conversation and, you know, might become unpleasant, but it's usually a one-on-one. But I've never had too much of a problem with that.
Interesting. What would you say in your 26 years experience in the Marine Corps was a surreal moment of accomplishment, either in meeting someone or some kind of accolade? What stands out to you the most in this time?
That's an easy one for me. There was a point in my time, I was stationed down in Bogota, Colombia, and I was the senior Marine responsible for advising the Colombian Marine Corps in their war against the FARC. And my mission was to train, equip, and advise them. And I had millions of dollars, which I was able to execute in helping them stand up riverine brigades and really help them turn, which at that point was had been, you know, a 60-year-long conflict. And we did really well. And we really got the mission accomplished. And I did so well that I was awarded the highest medal that a foreigner can be given by the Colombian military. And it was actually presented to me by the president of Colombia personally.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
It was amazing.
What about with the U.S. government? Have you ever found yourself at the White House or with the Joint Chiefs?
No, I can't say that I ever have. I've had a number of engagements with that level of officer. Most of them have been actually up here in New York City. There's a number of events that bring some pretty high-ranking individuals. You know, you've got some organizations like the Marine Corps Law Enforcement Foundation, the Intrepid Ball, which brings some pretty senior level players up to the city during, you know, non-COVID times for some big events. But I have not spent really any time in DC in the Pentagon in my career. I've always been more towards the edges of the empire.
You've traveled to everywhere in the world for the most part, correct? You've seen it all.
You know, I can't say I've seen it all. Fact is, I feel like I've only, you know, hit the tip of the iceberg. I've very well traveled through Central and South America and the Caribbean. Fact is, I think there's only one country down there I haven't been to. Good portion of Europe, a little bit of Africa, obviously the Middle East. But amazingly, unlike many of my brothers and sisters in the Marine Corps, I have never gotten a chance to go serve out in the Pacific. But frankly, you know, obviously the events of the past couple decades have, you know, kept a lot of us focused in some very specific areas.
Again, relating this to business without getting too personal or however you feel comfortable fielding the question, what have been some challenges that you really can't be prepared for from a manual or from someone telling you about that you've gone through? How have you overcome them? And how do you advise people that are experiencing or witnessing something unimaginable for the first time?
Yeah, you know, I think when you, particularly when you come in as a junior officer, but even those who are more senior, you get this impression that, you know, people will just automatically do what they're supposed to do. And the reality is that's not the case. And something that's really not taught well, though I've learned over the years, is that everybody has a different personality. And I'm a big believer in personality testings. It's one of the things that I introduced to my unit. We all took real colors. In the past, I've used Myers-Briggs. And that's learning how to communicate more effectively with each and every individual as an individual, despite the fact that we're in a big organization like the Marine Corps, and figuring out the method and the manner in which I can communicate, you know, my message most effectively to them in a way that they're going to pick it up and that it'll internalize. That's something you're not going to find in a manual, and it takes time and practice. It takes a lot of emotional intelligence. And every day, I've always found that to get the most out of people and get that to that peak performance is you really got to have that almost instant intuition of how they're doing that day and what they need that day, that moment, to drive them up a notch. And sometimes it's cheerleading. Sometimes it's something a little bit more firm. Sometimes it's just participation with them. It really runs the gamut. And that is a skill that I just don't think you can be taught. It's something you really have to experience and practice.
As someone who has gone through all the training and with personality tests, you knowing how to size someone up, what is it like as a parent trying to, I don't know the right word, work with your kids or discipline your kids? Is your approach almost rooted in the military and was your father's and your grandfather's because that was so much of your identity?
No, you know, it's interesting that with my kids, I have found that I try to be more natural. I try not to overthink the process. I really try to focus on just having good experiences with them. I don't get, up until now, a whole lot of time with them. I've traveled a lot. I've been gone a lot. So I really just try to focus on making the time that I have with them memorable and just share it with them. I don't try too much to think. And then there are times where I'm trying to manipulate them towards performance, good grades, all that. But usually at some point, I'm just trying to be a dad to them. You know, it's probably not the best answer.
No, it's actually a really good answer because I know what you mean. It's said in work that some of the very successful CEOs or presidents, heads of companies, innovators, people that have invented or come up with new ways of doing things, they've been judged as spouses or as parents, not having the right work, personal life balance. Being someone where your schedule is determined and dictated by someone else, what is your opinion or feeling on work-life balance, and is it possible to have it all?
I don't know if it's possible to have it all. I'm certainly guilty, and I was to a large degree in charge of my schedule, particularly the last 3 years. I didn't have to travel as much as I did, but I had the responsibility to all those people who did work for me, and I've always been guilty of being a workaholic, and I'm certainly guilty of not having performed as well as a father and as a spouse as I have as a Marine officer. There's no doubt in my mind. I don't know how you do it all. I really have never figured that out. And now that's something that in this transition that I'm trying to figure out a way in which I can do that.
I appreciate you being honest, because that's something that I myself have struggled with, and looking at the number of hours that I spend with Connects or with the My Mistakes podcast, so much time goes into it. I've often asked other people who are very immersed in their business, how do they do it all? And they had the same answer that you just did, for the most part, just as far as being in control of your own schedule. But sometimes people feel that just because you're in charge of setting your own schedule, that means that you can kind of be a absentee leader or someone who's not present. But I think you know what it takes to succeed in this. Now, this transition that you're making right now, can you explain to listeners, what is this called? Where has it landed you? What is the purpose for it?
Sure. So, you know, obviously we're living here in Garden City and in East Northport on Long Island here the past 3 years, and my kids have really started to thrive. We've fallen in love with Long Island. My wife asked, hey, can we get our kids through high school here and not have to move again, at least until they're done through high school? And so I agreed to that, which forces a decision for me to exit the Marine Corps. And we use the term retirement, and it is retiring from the military, comes with a pension. We tend to use the term transition because when people hear retirement, they think that you're done for good. I do have to transition. I got to find a job and I guess stop being a big kid. So I'm in the middle of the throes of that. Been very fortunate. I was able to get plugged into a program that's hosted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They have a foundation, which they formed an organization called Hiring Our Heroes. They have a program, corporate fellowship program, where you interview with companies and you get to basically intern for the last few months of your active duty time with a business. The business doesn't have to pay you. They get free labor, but they get to check you out. You check them out. And then hopefully there's a job offer on the back end. So I'm doing that right now with a fantastic solar company here on Long Island called Biltwell Solar, and getting a chance to, you know, explore my first toes into the water of the civilian world.
Do you think that this transition is something that will be simple for you with all that you've accomplished, or do you see where there'll be challenges entering into a world without the same order that you've been accustomed to?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything simple about this. I was very excited. I made this decision pre-COVID. Obviously, it was like the best employment time possible. I mean, there was basically zero unemployment. So I was very excited. I thought it was a good time to exit. Obviously, COVID changed all that. So there's nothing easy right now about doing a complete shift, trying to find a new direction. You know, even though I'm a senior leader in the Marine Corps, you know, and while I have certain domains of knowledge, processes that are very mature and at the executive level, I have not spent any time in specific industries. So there are some real challenges in that transition, and just learning the jargon of whichever industry you go into is a challenge. And even knowing what the day in the life is like in pick an industry is difficult to discern, which is why networking is so helpful. Just having a conversation with somebody in a different industry and asking them what their day is like.
Yeah, and I think that's what you'll find with business. No two people's days are the same. And when you speak to those that are successful, and I don't just mean financially, but successful in building a team and having those that work under you that respect you, I think you will see some of those traits you've seen in the military. I'm very impressed just with even you, the way you answer questions. You can tell that there's some kind of training. You don't have all the where even answering a question, you might take a second to process it. Like, you do everything the way that I've studied it's supposed to be done when answering questions or having a dialogue with someone. So I think you are going to have a leg up on the competition in the real world, quote unquote, real world, or transitioning here. I think you're going to stand out just because of what's been instilled in you, but I could definitely imagine where there would be some challenges, because I think you're going to be let down that other people around you aren't rooted with those same values. So that'll be a challenge. Well, I really thank you for taking time to share your experiences, because with so many people that go out and start businesses, and I myself being one, not realizing until now that it's the same principles for success, no matter what profession, whether if it's raising your children, whether it's having healthy relationships with friends or loved ones. It's those things that you just said as far as trust, communication, setting an example by doing, having an open door policy where people can speak to you or come to you, allowing people to screw up and not judging them for it and seeing how they react to it as a measure of a person. So I think you have all those deep within you and rooted in you. So I think any company, I think Dan and Nancy from Biltwell Solar were very smart to choose you. And I think you're lucky to have them because I know they genuinely care as great people. Glad to have met you. And as I said, there's so much I want to pick from your brain as far as leadership and see if I can transition into someone with a little bit more structure, like the United States Marine Corps, without having to go through all the training that I don't quite think I could make it through.
You would have made a fantastic Marine, Chris, but you know, you've got all the prerequisite poise, presence. I'm very impressed with Connects, and you can see the emotional buy-in from the members there. And I was very excited to see it over this past week, and I look forward to further conversations with you. And I'm always at your service as well. If you ever need any advice or just need someone to bounce something off of, I'm at your beck and call.
And you better believe I'm going to take you up on that. So thank you so much, Ivan. It's been great.
Hey, thanks, Chris. You too.
For more info, visit getconnex.com. That's GETCONNEXX.com. Or visit us on Facebook at Connex, INC, or on Instagram at Connex_. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Don Pablo. Boulder Coffee is roasted in small batches, providing the freshest tasting coffee imaginable. Simply put, it's a better cup of coffee. Order on Amazon or at DonPabloCoffee.com.